Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning, November 2nd. Happy November! So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. You can hear us from anywhere online by going to 883wppb.org. Each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com, and each show is turned into a podcast so you can hear the show at your leisure. Well, congratulations, Washington Nationals. What a World Series. Game 7. Wow. And the Nationals won it in Houston, beating the Astros 6-2, winning their first World Series championship since 1924. You know what? The Nationals won all four games on the road. That's just crazy. Well, a parade will be honoring the Nationals. It's set for this afternoon in D.C., beginning at 2. And, you know, the whole district is on a roll regarding their pro sports teams. The Caps won the Stanley Cup last year in 2018. And actually, the WNBA team, the Mystics, they recently won their first WNBA crown. So, and now Major League Baseball. So they've done very, very well. In the NFL, the Giants will face the Cowboys Monday night, MetLife Stadium. Cowboys, they're 4-3. They lead the division. They're coming off a bye week. Giants, 2-6, looking to snap a four-game losing streak. Well, the Cowboys have beaten the Giants five straight times, including in the season opener, 35-17 was that score for the Dallas win. Quarterback Dak Prescott, he is 68 of 101 for 1,053 yards, 9 touchdowns, no interceptions in their last 3 matchups. And of course, Daniel Jones for the Giants, he will have his first start against the Cowboys. He did get into that season opener game, but this will be his very first start against the Dallas Cowboys. The Jets, they will be in Miami to play the Dolphins, 1 p.m. start. Dolphins are winless, and they blew a 14-point lead against the Steelers on Monday Night Football. And meanwhile, the Jets aren't faring much better. They've been outscored 62-15 in back-to-back losses to New England and Jacksonville. That's always been quite the rivalry, Jets-Dolphins. Hopefully the Jets can beat the winless Dolphins this time around. All right, well, this morning I have a treat for you, whether you're a sports fan, a history fan, just people fan. I'll play 2 classic sports interview shows for you. And those of you who listen to this show regularly know that Sports Interview with Ann Liguori aired every week on cable from 1989 through 2008 and featured half-hour interviews with top sports legends. Well, this morning, you'll hear an interview I did with former New York Yankees pitcher Jim Boughton, who we recently lost at the age of 80. He passed away this past July. But I just remember Jim to be so smart, so sharp, so talented. He pitched for the Yankees from 1962 to 1968. He helped the Yankees win the World Series in 62. He told me his most memorable moment was earning his 20th game in 1963, clinching the pennant against the Minnesota Twins on a very cold evening in Minnesota. He said his average salary in all the years he played, average salary was $19,000. He told me the year he went 21-7, he only made $10,500. Just incredible compared to what the players are making now. After a stint with the Yankees, Jim Boughton went on to play for Seattle. He played for the Houston Astros. He played for the Braves. He did a lot of things after he retired from baseball, including becoming a sports anchor in New York. He became an actor, and of course, he wrote the highly controversial book, Ball 4. And this morning, you'll hear the real reason Jim thought that his book, Ball 4, caused such a ruckus at the time. It was a diary of the off-the-field side of baseball. It included a lot of things that were never really written about. Baseball commissioner Bowie Kuhn called Ball 4 detrimental to baseball. He tried to force Jim Boughton to sign a statement saying that the book was completely fictional. Of course, Boughton refused to do that. And his teammates, some of his teammates never forgave him for disclosing information that, you know, they thought was really held in confidence and naming some names. And he became unpopular with, you know, various players, coaches, officials on other teams, and was informally blacklisted from baseball. But just a fascinating personality and so smart and great writer. And you will hear Jim Bouton tell his story this morning on a classic sports interview. And similar to Jim Bouton, Rocky Blyer is a fascinating personality. Rocky was a halfback for the Pittsburgh Steelers in 1968, then from 1970 to 1980. After his rookie season with the Steelers, Rocky Blyer was drafted into the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. He was wounded in the left thigh by an enemy rifle bullet when his platoon was ambushed in a rice paddy. And while he was down, an enemy grenade landed nearby, bouncing off a fellow soldier, sending shrapnel into his lower right leg. So he lost part of his right foot in that blast. And he went on to win a Bronze Star, a Purple Heart. Doctors told him when he was in a hospital in Tokyo that he could never play football again. Art Rooney, the Steelers owner, had sent him a postcard which read, "Rock, the team's not doing well. We need you, Art Rooney." And Blyer went on to rejoin the team. He obviously had to overcome all sorts of obstacles, had to gain weight and get back into shape. And after several attempts, he made the team and eventually became a four-time Super Bowl champion. It's just an incredible comeback story. You will not want to miss this interview that I did with Rocky Blyer years ago, where he shares his own incredible story. He's quite the inspiration and continues to do a lot of great public speaking, motivational speaking, not only in Pittsburgh, but around the country. Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. PeakVision.com. That's P-E-A-K Vision.com.
Hi, I'm Ann LaGoria. My guest is Jim Bouton. And how do I introduce Jim Bouton? Former Yankee
very
pitcher.
Very carefully.
Very carefully. Entrepreneur, sportscaster, actor, businessman. I mean, you name it, you've done it. And that's what intrigues me so much about your career, is that baseball just seemed to be a little part of what you're doing.
Well, I never counted on baseball as a career. Matter of fact, when I was in high school, I had no idea what I was going to do with my life.
You wanted to be a forest ranger, right?
And I didn't want to be a forest ranger, but I had to do a report for Careers Week. And the teacher said that, you know, you should do it on something that you would you think you might enjoy. And but don't do it on baseball, because do it on something you would have a realistic chance of becoming. So, well, I'm not a baseball player. So I did.
So it was the teacher who didn't think that
she didn't think
you
I could play.
Well,
I didn't think so either. I sat on the bench in high school. I was a bench warmer. My nickname was Warm Up Bouton, because all I ever did was warm up. I never got into the games. And so I didn't think I would be a baseball player either.
So how'd you go from being the warm-up kid
to
pitching for the Yankees in two World Series?
I finally got a chance to pitch in the summertime for a Legion team. And then my senior year, I got to pitch a little bit in high school. And I was a walk-on at Western Michigan University, a non-scholarship pitcher. And I started to develop into a pretty good pitcher. And after my freshman year in college, I pitched in a tournament in Battle Creek. There were a lot of scouts there, and so based on this one game I pitched in this tournament, they offered me a contract. That was it.
Kind of like Whitey Ford, who told me that had the scouts looked at him in high school, he never would have gone on to the big leagues.
Sure.
He said he had no speed, no power.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, today, Whitey Ford and I would never sign contracts, because they're not looking for guys who are gritty and crafty and smart and hardworking. They're looking for guys that are 6 feet four and throw the ball 200 miles an hour. basically, they're looking for big, strong guys, and they figure they can teach them what they don't need to know. So the ball players today are not as skilled in certain things. They're not as good at bunting, hitting and running, you know, doing the little things, hitting the cutoff man. But they are more talented. They're bigger, they're faster, they're stronger. And if the guys from my era walked off the field and played guys today, we'd score 3 or 4 runs doing the little things, and we'd lose 12-3.
Even though the guys today your era knew the fundamentals better.
We knew the fundamentals, but you don't win ball games on fundamentals today. You win it on power, speed, strength. Players are just, they're bigger. They're in better shape. They come to spring training, they're already in shape. It's a year-round business. They're lifting weights. They're working with weight machines. We didn't do any of that.
I mean, I can remember the picture I had of a ball player with a pudgy stomach.
Yeah. A little bit of a gut. We would go to spring training. We'd go to spring training, and the idea was to lose weight in spring training. Try to lose enough weight to start the season.
From all the eating you did.
Right, from all those, from the rubber chicken circuit. And you had to go to all those dinners because that's the only way you could make any money. You never made any money as a baseball player.
Yeah. Boy, have times changed. Now tell me about the hat. Every time you pitched, your hat fell off.
Well, it was not that the hat was too big. It was that my motion, when I threw the ball, I would violently throw the top part of my body forward. It was like snapping a whip. And so the top part of my body would whip forward and my hat would pop off.
Full dog bounce?
I couldn't keep it on.
Pretty intense, if you ask me.
Well, when you're, I was 5'11", 185 pounds. And, for me to throw the ball as hard as I threw it, I had to get my whole body into it. Took everything I had. Had to throw the whole thing toward home plate.
So you came up with Pepitone and fill-ins. Tell me the harmonica story, because I know Yogi Berra was pretty upset that one day in the bus.
Yeah, well, this is in 1964 when we were fighting for a pennant. We were in fourth place, a couple of games out, and so about 3 weeks to go in the season. We had just lost a tough doubleheader against the White Sox, and we're taking the bus on a Sunday night, south side of Chicago, all the way up to O'Hare Airport on the north side, and it's a long bus ride, a lot of traffic on a Sunday night. It's dark. It's quiet on the bus, nobody's saying anything. Because when you lose, you have to, pretend your whole family just got wiped out. You have to be quiet so to show everybody that you care, otherwise you don't care. So you have to play, morgue. The bus is a rolling morgue is what it is. And Phil Lintz, who's a very happy-go-lucky guy, he was my roommate, and he happened to have bought a harmonica that morning before the bus left for the ballpark. Popped into a little drugstore, bought one of these Hohner harmonicas. Now, after this doubleheader loss, in which Phil didn't get to play, even though he was hitting 300, he didn't play. So he didn't contribute to these two losses. When Yogi, who was sitting up in the front of the bus, heard somebody in the back playing a harmonica, he stood up and he told Phil what he wanted. He didn't know who was doing it. He said, right. Whoever's got that harmonica, knock it off. And Phil, the rumor is that the legend has it that Phil turned to Mickey Mantle and said, "What did he say?" And Mickey said, "Play it louder." But that's not actually what happened. So Phil didn't feel like knocking it off. He wanted to play his harmonica. He didn't cause the loss of those two games. He should have been in the lineup. Now he's going to play his harmonica. So he keeps playing. Finally, Yogi comes storming to the back of the bus. He said, "I told you to shove that harmonica." And Phil takes the harmonica and he flips it to Yogi and he says, "Here, you do it." And Yogi swats at the harmonica with his hand, smashes it down into Joe Pepitone's kneecap. Now Pepitone's in the aisle of the bus going, "Oh, my knee, oh, my knee." And everybody on the bus is biting their lips to try to keep from laughing. Frank Rossetti stands up in the front of the bus and he screams that this is the worst thing he's ever seen in his entire career with the Yankees. The writers are all writing about how the team is falling apart and we're racked with dissension and we have no respect for the manager and we have no chance to win the pennant. And so we leave Chicago, we fly to Boston, and we start winning ball games. I think we won, I don't know what we won, 18 out of 22 ball games. We win the pennant and everybody says, "The harmonica incident." Yes, that was the turning point. That brought us all together.
A little harmonica and a little disrespect will get
right.
You
That's right.
Everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And when we come back, we'll talk about all the other things that this former Yankee pitcher did with his life. We'll be right back with Jim Bouton right after this. We're back with Jim Bouton, author of, among many things, Ball 4. And the latest, your first novel, Strike Zone. Let's first talk about Ball 4. This was written in 1970.
Yes.
And it was such a sensation. Do you think it would have been such a hit had Commissioner Huey Kuhn not made such a fuss about it?
Well, he certainly made it controversial. But I think the reason it sold as many books as it did was because it was a funny book about some very interesting people. And whether the commissioner didn't like it or liked it, I think people would have ultimately discovered that and would have enjoyed reading the book.
And just because you talked about stuff that was really going on in baseball, the realities of the carousing and the infidelity and the peeping Toms and all the fun that these guys had, not that I'm saying it was justifiable,
that kind of a book. It's not an expose. Yes, it's a daily diary of a professional baseball team that shows that ball players are human beings, but it is not a book about carousing and drinking and taking pep pills.
So what's the big fuss then? Why do the Yankees not invite you back to their old-timers games? Why has it been so long since you heard from Mickey Mantle? Just because of this book?
Yeah, I think that's probably it.
They probably didn't even read the book, right? Mickey
Mantle? That's it, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure most of the people who in baseball who were critical of it, like Huey Kuhn, didn't read the book.
And he went on to write his own.
I'm not sure. Yeah, exactly. In which he said worse things about baseball than I ever did in Ball 4. What angered the baseball commissioner and the owners was not that I told locker room secrets. It was that Ball 4 was the first book to tell people how difficult it was to make a living in baseball. There are a lot of contract negotiation talks in there. It shows how the owners abused the players, took advantage of them, and they did not want people reading this. They didn't want a judge to read it, a jury, an arbitrator, a congressman, because they were afraid they might lose their antitrust exemption or their reserve clause. And ironically, that's exactly what happened. In 1975, at the Andy Messersmith arbitration hearing, I was asked to testify. I was the only former player called to testify, and I read passages from Ball 4, which was accepted as legal evidence against the owners because it was based on contemporaneous notes. So they were right to be afraid of Ball 4 as an instrument of change as far as the economics of the game are concerned.
And is it true that Mickey Mantle never talked to you after you wrote this book?
I know I didn't speak to Mickey for many years after Ball 4. This past winter, I wrote him a note after his son passed away, telling him how badly I felt about that, and also telling him how much I admired him for going into the Betty Ford Clinic, which I thought took a lot of courage. Mickey got my note because he called me and left a message on my answering machine at my office. I wasn't in. But it was a nice message, and I wrote him another note telling him I got his message. So we have communicated with each other, even though we haven't spoken.
Would you ever feel like you just should talk to him and clear the air and say, what's the deal? Or wouldn't he not have really had any reason to call you anyway?
One of the things
know how close you were when you played.
One of the things that, we were not close friends because I was too young. I was 10 years younger. We didn't hang out with Mickey and Whitey and the boys. We'd go out, maybe have a few drinks or go out to dinner once in a while, but we were not pals. Phil Lindz and I hung around together. Fritz Peterson and I hung around together, didn't hang out with Mickey Mantle. But I think that, I don't think Mickey was responsible for me not being invited back to Old Timers Day. As a matter of fact, one of the things that he'd said to me in his phone phone message was that he was not the one that said he didn't want me going back to Old Timers Day. So I don't know why I don't get invited back to Old Timers Day. Maybe it's George Steinbrenner.
Do you care, though?
No, it doesn't really. I have more fun with the distinction of being the only guy not being invited back than if they actually had me back there.
So looking back, would you have done anything differently with Ball 4? Said anything differently? Said more, maybe?
No, I don't think so. I think I showed a lot of restraint in Ball 4. I didn't name any names as far as the sexy stories are concerned. I didn't quote any ball players making anti-Semitic remarks, and I heard enough of those. I didn't quote any ball players making racial remarks. I certainly heard enough of those. So I didn't write everything that I heard or saw.
You really could have gotten a lot of people in trouble.
I used some judgment, and so, the idea that I was a tell-all is just not true.
And Strike Zone is your first attempt at a novel, and you did it with a man who already wrote.
Elliot Aisenoff was the author of Eight Men Out, which is a great story about the Black Sox scandal, the Chicago White Sox fixing the 1919 World Series. This book was Elliot's idea. Everywhere he would go around the country talking about the ballplayers fixing ball games, people would always ask him if ball games could be fixed today. And Elliot would always say, no, you couldn't fix a ball game today because the players are making too much money. But you could get the home plate umpire, maybe. So he had this idea of a ball game being fixed by the home plate umpire. His idea was that he would write the umpire's view of this game, and I would write the pitcher against whom the game is being fixed.
But do you think it really happened? Has it happened?
If it has happened, and it's been successful, nobody would know about it. You know, you only find out about a fix if somebody gets caught. This book would show somebody how a ball game could be fixed, and nobody would know.
We'll be back with Jim Bouton right after this to discover what else he's been up to. There's a lot to talk about. We'll be right back. We're back with Jim Bouton, entrepreneur, former Yankee ballplayer. Ralph Terry once said to you, before a World Series game, I guess to help put your mind at ease, it doesn't matter whether you win or lose, just remember there are 600 million Chinese people who don't give a damn.
Right.
Do you remember that?
This was just before the 1963 World Series.
Did that help?
Oh, yeah, that helped.
Because he has a point there, Ralph Terry.
I was sitting on the bench, and I was very nervous, you know, about to go out and pitch in front of 70,000 people. This is only my second year in the big league. Never been in a World Series before. Millions are watching on television. I know I'm going to walk that first batter, Maury Wills. Maury Wills broke Ty Cobb's base stealing record that summer. I'm going to walk Maury Wills. He's going to steal second. She's going to steal third. He's going to steal home. I'm going to be humiliated on national television. And while I was thinking these terrible thoughts, Ralph came over, put his arm around my shoulder, and he says, just remember one thing, kid, when you're out there, no matter what happens, win or lose, 500 million Chinese communists don't give a damn. So
I wonder if Ralph Terry thought the same way when he gave up that home run.
Just then the umpire yelled play. Well, Ralph always was able to keep things in perspective. That's a nice thing about Ralph. So the umpire yelled play ball. I ran on the mound, and I said, that's right. Half the world doesn't care about what happens out here today. I'm lucky to be alive. I'm in a World Series. This is fun. And I, you know, eventually lost the game. But I only lost 1-0. It was a four-hitter, and I'm convinced that I did as well as I did in that game because I was having fun pitching in the World Series. And this is actually the subject of my speech.
I was just going to say.
I do motivational speaking for corporations.
Right.
And the thing that I try to get their people to do, their salespeople, their business executive, their management staff, is to value the process rather than the goal.
Right.
Focus on the process. Have fun with what you're doing, because when you're having fun, your body and your mind work creatively, instinctively, and you always end up with a better job, a better product.
Right. Parents should understand that when they're pushing their kids.
Goals exactly.
Little league.
You should never ask
sport.
A kid, did you win or lose? You'd always say, did you have a good time? Did you learn anything new? Not whether did you win or lose. Because this competition thing, to win and be number one and beat the other guy, you lose. In the process, you lose why you do something
sure.
in the first place.
Are you upset there's no baseball?
Well, I'm just angry at the owners for what they've done to this game. And I was talking to a guy I played minor league ball with a couple of years, you know, back when I was making my comeback, and he said to me over the telephone, he says, you know what these owners don't understand? It's not their game. It's not their game.
But without them, we
and
wouldn't have the teams.
Absolutely right. That's not true. It's not true. You had baseball players playing baseball, and you had other people watching them long before you had owners. Okay? Owners are just basically agents for the players. They come in there, they negotiate a television contract, and they negotiate stadium leases. What else do they do? They don't have any other job.
They should get another league going with no owners.
Out of it. Exactly right. The Players Association could negotiate a television contract. They could negotiate stadium leases. What do you need owners for?
Why don't they? They
might have to. I think they're going to be doing that. What do the owners own? They don't have factories. They don't have raw materials. All they own is logos. Well, you don't need logos to play baseball.
So get together some big investors and
there
start
are some
your
people
own
right now who are in the process of doing that very thing.
And are you behind them?
I may be involved. Don't know yet. Too early to tell.
I see you doing it. Why not?
I'd like that.
You've done all these other things.
That would be a challenge. To me, the owners, they took such terrible advantage of the players years ago with the reserve clause, not paying us our share of the money that was being made. We were getting like 10-15% of the total revenues that came in. They were stealing our money. I have no sympathy for the owners. Hmm. If I were Bud Selig, the first thing I'd do is...
How would you solve the problem?
First thing I would do is I would apologize to baseball. I would apologize to the players. I'd apologize to the fans. And I would say that in behalf of the owners, I would like to say that what we've done is a terrible thing. Just because we can't behave like real businessmen, just because we can't control our own spending, we expect the players to bail us out and help us out here. It's not fair. It's not reasonable. And so I would apologize for that.
Will those fans come back, though, you think?
Sure. As a matter of fact, the guys who want to boycott and set up these clubs of people who are supposed to stay away from the game, I said, these are the guys who are going to be first in line when the tickets go back on sale. I mean, anybody whose life revolves around baseball, I feel sorry for them in the first place.
Get a life, buddy.
Exactly. If your life falls apart because it's a baseball strike, you're going to be the first guy buying tickets when they come back on sale, because these are the people who don't have anything else. The people I feel sorry for are the people who don't even go to the ball games, the people who are hospitalized, shut-ins, people all over the country who rely on listening to a ball game on the radio or watching on television to provide entertainment in their lives. These are the ones I feel sorry for, not the fans who can afford to go.
Well, even the people at home affording to see the game,
sure,
on pay-per-view,
yeah,
which mm-hmm. might happen, and mm-hmm. all the cable
yeah.
stations that they have to pay.
Yeah, and I'd get rid of the three-league concept. I think the wild card idea is ridiculous. Go back to the two divisions. I'd fix
that.
You
don't like the realignment?
No. Terrible.
Anything else?
Get rid of rock music between innings. You go to the ball game, you're blasted with this music. I mean, you can't sit there in peace and quiet and just enjoy the fact that you're outside at a ball game in this wonderful stadium and enjoy the noise of the crowd and the peacefulness of the afternoon. Have a decent conversation with the person sitting next to you. You can't do that. You're being constantly bombarded. As soon as the last out of the inning comes in, music comes in, bam, 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 and the scoreboard is blasting messages at you, and it's terrible.
So you want it back to how it was when you played?
Yeah, a little more nostalgia, only with the players getting paid.
You wish you had that money back then, right? But it's all relative, right?
No, it's not relative. The money that we made was not relative to the money that the players are making today. And to make an average salary, for example, of $19,000, that was my salary, $19,000.
So you had to do
salary.
All this other stuff just to.
Oh yeah, you needed
pay
to have
rent.
Another life. Yeah, I used to play pickup basketball games with Phil Linz and Ed Crane Pool. We'd play local high school coaches. We'd make $50 a game, playing basketball in the off season, and we needed that money. The year I was 21-7, my salary was $10,500. And that kind of control, that power, the owners didn't use any fairness. They didn't treat the players respectfully. They could have said, okay, we've got all this power, but let's not take advantage of it. Let's give the players the benefit of the doubt. Let's pay them decently. You give these guys this kind of power, they're going to take advantage of it. That's why it's very important for the players to hold together in the strike, so that they don't give the owners that kind of control over their lives anymore. Winning my 20th game and clinching the pennant in 1963, I beat the Minnesota Twins 2-0. I think it was a four-hitter up in Minnesota on a cold night with Phil Linz in center field and a ragtag outfield. All the big guys were sitting on the bench, and we won that game 2-0 against Camilo Pascual.
Sports Interview with Allegory is brought to you by June Jewelry and My Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. PeakVision.com. That's PeakVision.com. We'll be right back.
Rocky Blyer, winner of 4 Super Bowls when he was a running back with the Pittsburgh Steelers. Welcome.
Thanks, Ann.
You look like you're in great shape.
I feel wonderful.
You look fine, even though you've been through a lot in your career, and I know now you are a motivational speaker and you talk about all that, so we want to get into your entire history, both as a football player and your experiences in Vietnam, which were incredible. I know they made a movie about it, and you wrote a book about it, the movie called Fighting Back,
right,
about your 2-year battle to overcome the injuries at Vietnam. Take us back. You get drafted in the next to the last round.
Yeah, I know. That was the biggest.
But you were lucky you got drafted because you were shorter than most and I guess slower.
Well, you know, it was always the, I suppose, the perception by a lot of people, one that we as individuals never really look at ourselves. I mean, I was thinking, well, you know, I look at myself in the mirror. I'm 6'2", got a lot of hair, you know. But in reality, I'm short and slow and did not have the speed that a lot of running backs, you know, had. And so my expectations of being drafted were, well, maybe in the middle rounds, 5th or 6th, and when they went by, and the 8th and 9th went by. Well, at that time also is that the draft was not a big exposure like you see it today on television or in the papers. And it was almost a 3-day affair. Because of time lapses and going through 17 rounds. So no one ever called me and said, well, congratulations, you are, the Pittsburgh Steelers have drafted you. I didn't sit around by my phones like a lot of athletes do today. As a matter of fact, I heard it on the 11 o'clock news in South Bend 3 days after it had taken place.
Hey, you got drafted?
Rocky Blyer got drafted 16th by the Pittsburgh Steelers. Now, I didn't know whether to be embarrassed by that or to be happy that I got drafted. And so I had gone to Pittsburgh then as a draft choice.
Your life is like a screenplay, so we have to cut to the next scene two here.
That's
right. You get drafted to the Vietnam War.
Yeah, so I go to Pittsburgh, and I make the team that year, and it's a 14-game season, and I get a chance to play 11 games. But within that 11-game short season, there was a lot of questions. I didn't get into a reserve. There was some question about my eligibility, and so my deferment had gone. And so all of a sudden, bang, I get a letter in the mail that from the U.S. Selective Service that you are cordially invited to join be drafted into the Army.
Cordially
invited to. Please report to the AP station at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning and to be inducted into the armed services. Well, my world just, fell apart at that time. Here I was, a dream come true in the minds of a lot of people, and mine as well, is that I had the opportunity to play professional football. Now I was a professional football player, had an apartment, had a car, and the next day it was taken away from me in that world, not knowing what was going to happen thereafter, and a 2-year commitment into the services.
Scene three
takes me automatically right over to Vietnam.
And you're almost in a near fatal accident. You are in a near fatal accident.
I get over to Vietnam. I've been in country 3.5 months. We were out in patrol, ran into an ambush, got shot the first time that day with a small arms fire. AK-47 bullet went through my left thigh. We were in a firefight for most of that day. Later on that afternoon, I got hit with a grenade that had blown up and blew up through my right foot and my right knee and my right thigh. As a matter of fact, that time, you don't worry about the future. You really worry about a life and death situation. If I'm going to get out of here, what's going to happen thereafter? And so I finally get extracted out of the jungle on about a 6-hour trek through the darkness that evening until a helicopter came in and pulled us out of there. Then I went to an aid station, got patched up, and then to Da Nang, where I got operated on for the first time, cleaned up the wounds, and spent about 5 days there before I was shipped over to Tokyo, where I spent 3 weeks in the hospital before I came back to the States, where I spent 9 months in the hospital. And the prognosis basically was that you'll be fine, but you'll never play this game of football again because the damage that had been done to at least my right foot and to the ligaments and to the muscle tissue there. Well, I had been injured before, as most athletes have, maybe not to this extent, but I didn't lose a foot, nor did I lose a leg. I was damaged, beat up, and given time, I thought to myself, given time, rehabilitation, I'll go back and play. And so what the doctor told me kind of went in one ear and out the other ear. I got a lot of support from people, or at least I didn't get any negative support, I should say. Nobody ever said, geez, you're crazy to do this. And so I was just a dumb, happy jock going through life saying, well, I can go do this again. Because basically, and I think one of the great lessons that I learned at the time is that what I really wanted to get accomplished or erase, because a lot of time we carry this throughout our life, is all those ifs and buts and could'ves and should'ves. If I would have done this or if I would have done that, it might have been. And so if you can erase those, then no matter where you go in life, at least you can go forward without having to look over your shoulder and carry all that garbage or baggage that we have a tendency to carry with us.
The story is only starting. And I understand it was a football move that pretty much saved your life. And when we come back with Rocky Blyer, we're going to find out how it is that he has survived that accident. We'll be back with Rocky Blyer. We're back with Rocky Blyer, who is trying to get all this in 1.5 hour, which is probably impossible. But your story is fascinating. You had a near fatal accident in Vietnam, and if it weren't for that, three man over under.
That's right.
Is that right?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the exercises that you learn in the game of football, at least that was taught to me through junior high and through high school, is really an over under man and body control, and basically is three guys standing there. One rolls, one jumps, the other one rolls. It's kind of an acrobatic, you know, move. Well, what had happened at the time when I was in Vietnam, now let's shoot that forward to that moment, is that we were under fire. I was lying up against a little hedge or the side of a road, and they were shooting over our heads. Well, my commanding officer was maybe about 6 feet from me, when all of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a grenade come flying through the air, and as he was lying prone, looking out over the action, it hit him right in the middle of the back. And it didn't go off, but it bounced off of him and started to roll where I was lying there. Well, in a matter of seconds, you had to decide which way to jump. And so all of a sudden, your reactions take over, your instinct takes over. And so now all of a sudden, I go back to the eighth grade, go back to high school. And as I see this grenade coming this way, it goes through the old man over and under technique. And so as this, I had to decide which way to jump. Do I run this way? Do I run this way? But as it comes this way, I jump the opposite way, jump over it, and as I do, it blows up then. And that's where
so
I get
the impact.
So
you're in the air while this thing's blowing up.
And why this thing's
had
blowing up.
Had you just rolled over, you would have been blown up.
Probably more than likely. And as I look back on it, I always think, thank God it was a Chinese grenade. It was a Chi-Com grenade, cheaply made. So if it was one
thank
of ours,
God it was cheap.
Cheaply made, if it was one of ours, I might not be here talking to you today, but at that time, and when it exploded out this way rather than up and out this way. And so as it did, it blew out this way. I, of course, was standing on top of it. I mean, it blew me up in the air from a concussion. Shrapnel did, you know, penetrate the right leg and the foot, as I said before.
Now, you were told by the doctor that you'd never walk again, mm-hmm. let alone play football and go on to win 4 Super Bowls with the Steelers. You wrote a letter at that point to the owner at that time, Art Rooney.
That's right.
And said, I'll be back.
I'll be back. I think that was a first positive mental imprint that I had put into my mind in that I thought, I will be back. You know, I just wanted to alleviate any fears that they might have had. I'm sure that they didn't have any at all, nor that they really thought about me. But in my mind, I thought, well, I just want to let them know that I will be back and that I want the opportunity when I get back to at least try to make that team.
Do you think he felt sorry for you? Is that why he let you come back like that?
I think there was a couple of things. Is that I think there was a certain maybe sympathy about it. I mean, here was a young kid that was extracted out of their team. went and fought in a very unpopular war. He's coming back, being the man in the family that he came from, that they were going to give me every chance and opportunity. I'm sure that in their mind they thought it would never work out, or that I would quit, or that something would happen. But there was that opportunity. And we all need breaks in our life, and sometimes you create your own break. But that first year they came back, I can remember I had gone through practice trying to make the team. The foot really wasn't as healthy and as strong as I had anticipated, and it took its toll over the two-a-day practices. And by the end of those practices, in the end of the weeks I was there, I mean, I was really limping badly until the final cut came. And Chuck Knoll, of course, as a head coach and decision maker on his players, called me into his office, a fear that every player has when he's trying to make a team, and said, geez, I think that you should go home, do whatever's necessary to get yourself back in shape, and come back the following year. Well, in my enthusiasm to try to make this team, I probably embarrassed myself as I look back on it, because I pleaded without almost crying,
really?
You know, is there anything that
you
I can do? And I wanted
year.
To stay that year. Because I always felt out of sight, out of mind.
Sure.
And
might be harder for you to go home and come back, the next year. Just be there and try to
be a part of it. Well,
sure.
He said, no, there's nothing we can do. And I can remember getting in my car, tears coming down. I thought my world was coming to an end, or at least not knowing what was going to take place. When the next day, Dan Rooney, who happened to be the son of Art Rooney Sr. And president, called me up and said, I'm sorry I wasn't there yesterday when Chuck made the final cuts. He said, I'd like you to come back in. He said, I've talked to our doctors, I've talked to Chuck. They think that there's something that they can do to help you. Chuck didn't really care, because they were going to put me on the injured reserve list, so it didn't take up a spot on his roster sheet, and so he said, come on back down. So they did, and that gave me an opportunity. I went back and had another operation, but again, I was there. So after that operation, being in the hospital, and when they did some more work and loosened up some of the ligaments that had really tightened up in my foot, at least I was able to go back to practice, sit in, and the meetings, and work out every day, and just kind of go through the therapy there. And I had an opportunity to come back at the end of the season, practiced for a few weeks, shoot it up for one game.
From the trenches in Vietnam to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Not part of that steel curtain, since you were a running back, but
right.
Part in some way, I guess. And when we come back with Rocky Blyer, we'll get more engrossed in this story. There's a lot more to get into. We'll be back with Rocky Blyer in a minute. We're back with Rocky Blyer, who went through an amazing experience in Vietnam to go back to get himself on the team with the Steelers, went on to be part of the four Super Bowl championships, and now is a motivational speaker. We'll get into that in a second. But when you look back, what was it when you were lying there and your body was injured and wounded from the grenade? What made you say, I'll be back?
Well, it was an experience. Having tasted it that one year, even it was a short part of that year, is that, I like playing professional football. I like what professional football gave me, within a sense of accomplishment. And so I wanted to do that. Now, what were my options at that time? Well, I could go back and work with my dad back in the bar and run a bar, or I could go on to graduate school, or I could go out to and get a job in the real world. Well, none of the three of those really appealed to me at the time.
I guess it was just wanting it so badly,
and I wanted to go back. That's what I wanted to do. And so, in doing that, I mean, it really, you know, helped me define what I wanted, how important, and some of the lessons that I at least get a chance to talk to people today about, in those barriers that we may face, those goals that we set. And that you really can accomplish anything you want if you're willing to do several things, and that is a belief in yourself, belief in your own talent, and willing to pay the price no matter what it might be, and not lose sight of what you want to achieve and have that goal very firmly situated within your mind.
Let's talk about the Steelers of today. I'm sure you still follow the team a little bit, I guess.
Yes, very much so. As the Steelers have developed over the 80s, and I think that's an important criterion which we should talk about, is that they really lived in the shadow of the 70s, and especially in the eyes of the fans. And as I had retired and as that team had retired within 80, 81, 82, and 83, and new players continued to develop and come through, is that they really, and my feeling is that those players, as a team developed, really didn't have a sense that that was their team, because all the time was thrown back, well, it's not like the 70s, or it's not the team of the 70s, or
sure.
It's
always being compared to this.
Always being compared.
Four Super Bowl championships.
And so finally, in my estimation, the team of last year, of 89, really emerged within its own. Well, what happened this year is every year it changes is that they've changed offensive coordinators. Tom Moore, who was the original offensive coordinator, went on to Minnesota, and they hired Joe Walton,
formerly the New York Jets head coach.
And he
originally from Pittsburgh.
Originally
so
from
back.
Pittsburgh, so he's kind of back home. But what he had done was that he came in and changed the whole offense. Changed not only the plays, but changed the terminology. Well, you have a young team coming up, and I don't care how much you try to drill it into them, it takes time for them to get used to that offense.
Let's talk about what you're doing here in New York now. I know you're involved in...
I'm national spokesperson for prostate cancer, and we had gone through over the last several weeks a prostate cancer awareness week in which we're really trying to get out to men that prostate cancer, and you have to understand this, is that that is number one cause of cancer within men,
really?
And it's the second leading killer of men. And yet nobody knows about it. One out of every nine Americans, one out of every 11 Americans, I should say, a man will get cancer. And so a year ago, we had started the awareness program, and we had 91 hospitals participate, giving free examinations across the country. There are about 1.2 million men walking around with prostate cancer that they don't know about it. And so the word that I'm trying to get out is really, go see your doctor, get a check, and make sure it's part of your annual check.
Come full circle with this man.
Sure.
From Vietnam, yeah. Your high school, college days, to your days with the Pittsburgh Steelers, yeah. And it's so nice to talk to you.
And thank
we'll
you very
have to
much.
Do it again in
so.
Part two sometime.
Part two, we'll get that one.
Thanks a lot.
It would have to be 1978, Super Bowl 13. Right before the halftime, the score was tied 14-14. We had moved the ball down. We had about 30 seconds left on the clock. We were on our 6-yard line on a broken pass play. Bradshaw hit me in the end zone on a pass that was maybe a little too high, and thrown a little too soon. And I leaped in the air, maybe 18, 19, 20 feet, I forget all after all these years. Grabbed that ball, came down into the end zone to give us a lead to go into the halftime that we carried, a lead that helped us win the game at the end.
Hope you enjoyed my classic sports interview with the late Jim Boughton and with Steelers great Rocky Blyer. And thanks to studio engineer Kyle Lynch. Have a wonderful weekend, and I will talk to you next Saturday morning from 9 to 10 right here on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.